ओम गणते मनंदस्य दिनो दिनो सुलकाया चक्षुष्मिलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः There are so many ways to look at Krishna. Of course, we can look at him in the deity form. We can look at him in the form of a picture, a tuning. Do you think you could get the first volume of the 10th canto? So, but that's not exactly what I mean, because we don't look at Krishna in that way, but we really look at Krishna with our consciousness. So depending upon what our consciousness is like, which basically means the quality of our mind, we will see Krishna in different ways. This is exhibited especially when Krishna, in a famous verse, unfortunately I don't know the Sanskrit, but when Krishna walks into the wrestling arena of Kamsa, in the 43rd verse after the chapter of the 10th canto, after the killing of Kuvalaya Pita, there were so many people in the grandstands, and they looked at Krishna, the same Krishna, but they all saw him in different ways. For example, Kamsa, when he looked at Krishna, Krishna came in after having killed the elephant, and he was sprinkled with the blood of the elephant. He and Balaram walked in, and they had, each of them had one of the elephant's tusks upon their shoulders, and they were very mighty looking. And when Kamsa looked at him, he saw Krishna as death personified. And when the wrestlers looked at him, they saw him as a thunderbolt. And when the Yadus looked at him, they saw him as the best of the Yadu dynasty, Yadu Shrestha. And when the ladies looked at him, they looked at him as the best of males. And when everyone was looking at Krishna differently, the most beautiful, the most darling child, all the mothers looked at him that way. So I wanted to go over right now how a different type of person sees Krishna, and that kind of a person is a demigod. So how the demigods view Krishna, in the Bhagavatam we hear quite a few. We hear how Varuna views him. Who else do we hear? What other demigods? Brahma, Indra, Lord Shiva, and even actually not a demigod, but we hear how one of his expansion of Shankarshan, known as Mahavishnu, in the 89th chapter, we hear how he views Krishna. How does he view Krishna? He's so eager to see him that he steals the sons of the Brahmin away. He knows that Krishna will have to come and get them, recover them from him. So particularly, how do the demigods view Krishna? So this is described in the second chapter of the 10th canto. And the circumstances are that Devaki has just given birth to Krishna. Of course, we know it's Vasudev Krishna. But the demigods, this is before... Oh, this is actually before she's given birth to Krishna. She is in the womb of of Devaki. Krishna's in the womb of Devaki. In this chapter, the second chapter, is called Prayers by Demigods for Lord Krishna. In the Krishna book, it's called the Prayers by the Demigods here. And in the Sanskrit, it's called the Garbha Stuti, which literally means the prayers to the womb. So, in which Krishna is situated. So one could think that how is it possible for God, who is, first of all, unlimited, and we don't expect him to come from the womb of anyone, Devaki or anyone, because that would appear that he is an ordinary person, because ordinary people come into this world through the womb. But Krishna, as he explains in the Bhagavad Gita, he comes sambhavam yatma mayaya, by virtue of his own energy, by virtue of his internal energy, by virtue of his mercy, his own mercy. That's also what sambhava yatma mayaya means. So, and the acharyas answer the question, the point that how could Krishna be in the womb of Devaki? And the answer in one way is that he's everywhere. He should be everywhere, but he's all pervading all of existence. Why shouldn't he be also easily to be present in the womb of Devaki? And when Krishna is present somewhere, he is completely aloof from that place in which he is present. If he is present in the heart also of Ishvara Sarvabhutanam, of even a pig, does that mean that he's contaminated by being with a pig? Because there's a saying that doesn't apply to Krishna at all. There's a saying, it's an English type of slang saying. If you go to sleep with dogs, you get up with fleas. How did you know that one? Don't anyone try this, by the way, as an experiment. But if you go to sleep with dogs, you get up with fleas, which is a very wise saying, that avoid bad association. But when Krishna goes to sleep with pigs, he doesn't become a pig, or doesn't become contaminated, doesn't gain any of the qualities, because he's actually never with the pig in the pig's body. He doesn't at all deal with the material energy at all. He's always existing in the Dham. He's always existing in his own internal energy. So we can say even that Krishna comes to the material world, he doesn't actually come to the material world. When Krishna is an incarnation, he is not incarnate. He is not within flesh. He is in his transcendental body, always surrounded by his transcendental associates, and he always has his lotus feet in the spiritual world. So when Krishna is in the womb of Devaki, the demigods come and they offer prayers. Just before that, the point being that let's see how the demigods will see Krishna. What is their vision of Krishna? Because the friends of Krishna see him as their best friend, just the best friend. How will the demigods see him? So, just a little before this, Kamsa finally decided not to kill Devaki right away, but to wait for the inevitable future. But his mind, he was going to kill her while she was with child, and he thought this would be abominable. Nowadays, people don't think it's so abominable to kill the child in the womb, but even though Kamsa was the worst possible demon, he thought it was a terrible thing. So he decided to wait for the future, but his mind became absorbed in animosity. What does animosity mean? Enmity. What does enmity mean?
Opposition.
Thinking that Krishna was his enemy. So his mind became absorbed in animosity against the Supreme Person, against the Personality of Godhead. So, although because what caused his animosity, especially, was his fear. So Kamsa, in the seventh canto of the Bhagavatam, is described fully absorbed, intensely absorbed in Krishna, but in fear. But this absorption is considered wonderful, but his mood of being against Krishna, pratikul, makes it that his absorption is not favorable, and it's not devotional, and it's not, of course, recommended either. But rather, one should become absorbed in thoughts of Krishna in full devotional love. That is the process of Krishna consciousness. And even there's one verse from the Garuda Purana that I can't remember the exact translation, but something to the effect of, if one becomes aware for one moment that he's not thinking about Krishna, he should immediately cry out the names of Krishna. In other words, any moment, any second or half of a second that one's consciousness is not absorbed in thoughts of Krishna, that's considered the most terrible loss and the greatest waste. So what a standard that is. What a realization that is. That any moment that one is not absorbed or thinking about Krishna, it's a waste of the thought, waste of an opportunity, a waste of life, and a waste of a bad trade, so to speak, of something wonderful for something terrible, something beneficial for something that is useless. So he was waiting patiently for the delivery of the child, expecting to kill him, as he had done previously the other babies of Devaki. Thus, being merged in an ocean of animosity against the Supreme Personality, against the Personality of Godhead, he began to think of Krishna, while Vishnu was sitting, while sleeping, while walking, while eating, while working. In all the situations of his life, he was just simply thinking, Krishna, Krishna, I have to kill him, Krishna, Krishna. His mind became so much absorbed with the thought of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that indirectly he could see only Krishna or Vishnu around him. He was completely Krishna conscious, but not in a proper way, but he was always conscious of Krishna. Everywhere he looked, because again, we don't see with our eyes, we see with our minds. So everywhere he looked, his consciousness only saw Krishna. Unfortunately, although his mind was so absorbed in the thought of Vishnu, he is not recognized as a devotee because he was thinking of Krishna as an enemy. The state of mind of a great devotee is also to be always absorbed in thoughts of Krishna, but a devotee thinks of him favorably, not unfavorably. To think of Krishna favorably is Krishna consciousness, but to think of him unfavorably is not Krishna consciousness. But to not thinking of him at all, that's also not Krishna consciousness. And the residents of Vrindavan are the foremost thinkers of Krishna. They're always absorbed in thoughts of him, and they're thinking of him favorably, but not only favorably, but with the most extreme love for Krishna. And therefore, as soon as Krishna is born, he's going to go there, to Vrindavan. He's going attracted by the amazing mood of the residents of Vrindavan, amazingly intimate, full of love, and full absorption in thinking of him, making Krishna their very life, the life of their life. So at that time, Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, accompanied by great sages like
Narada.
Yes, and followed by many other demigods, invisibly appeared in the house of Kamsa. They began to pray to the Supreme Personality of Godhead in select verses, which are very pleasing to the devotees, and which award fulfillment of their desires. Now that's something that's interesting. These prayers award fulfillment of the desires of the devotee and their devotees, and they are very pleasing to the devotees. Now, the first verse is quite an interesting one of their prayers, and a very famous one. This is the first thing they say, not famous in the sense that everyone knows it, but famous in the sense that it's quoted by many of the acharyas. And you'll understand why when I read it, even in the Sanskrit. So here's the first verse. Now, what do you notice? I'll read it. And what do you notice about this verse? Satyavatam satyaparam trisatyam satyasya yonim nahitam cha satye satyasya satyam vitasatya netram satyatmakam tvam saranam prapanna. What did you notice? Did you notice that? There's how many times? Satyavratam. Satyavratam means what? He's always his vow is always kept. And it's also interesting because in the first volume of the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam is one that Prabhupada himself translated and wrote purports on it. These were the last of the books that he actually himself translated. So we have the opportunity to read some of the thoughts of Prabhupada near the end of his manifest existence. So there's a note here that the Lord vows, this is Satyavratam, Yada Yada Hidamasya Kanir Bhavati Bharata To honor this vow, the Lord appeared whenever there is a decline in religious principles and an uprising of irreligion. I invent myself birth after birth, time after time. Adhamasya, abhutanam adhamasya. And when there's a rise of irreligion. So to honor this vow, the Lord appeared. So Satyavratam, Satyaparam, that means the absolute truth, the supreme truth. And this is what the first verse in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, Satyam Param Dhimahi. It's a meditation. Srila Vyasadeva speaks that verse as a janmadyasya yataha anvaratesyateshu svarat, speaking about the glories of Krishna. He's practically defining the absolute truth, and upon this absolute truth he ends that verse with, upon this absolute truth I meditate, satyam param dhimahi. So satyavratam satyaparam trisatyam. Trisatyam means He is always present as the absolute truth before the creation, during the time of creation, and after the creation is annihilated. This is also explained in the Bhagavatam, in one of the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam verses, Aham Eva Sameva Gai. It was only Krishna. Before the material existence had manifest, he was still present. And after material existence is going to be unmanifest, he will be present. And also in between, he's present. In the span of time where material existence is manifest, he's also present. So he's chisatyam, he's in all features of time, past, present, and future. This is material time. He is present. So they're glorifying him. He's always true to his vow, because that's the first thing they say, because the demigods, as described in the first chapter of the 10th canto, when Bhumi, she was distressed, she came to Lord Brahma in the form of a cow, and she said, there's such an overburdening of the earth with these demonic forces of kings. There's like a plan and a plot to take over the earth, because the demons had all taken their birth, the asuras had all taken their birth, and it was so distressing to Bhumi that she complained to Brahma and brought her petition before him, and because he was favorable, he accepted it, and he went to the ocean of milk and began to, he called the council of demigods actually, and they all went to the ocean of milk and they began to pray, and there was a voice that Brahma could hear, who told him in the heart that, yes, I'm coming. So the first thing that they say is Satyavratam, you're true to your vow, because you said you were coming, and indeed you came. And it wasn't even on IST, Indian stretchable time. He came on time. And he's who came? The absolute truth. Satyaparam, who is true, because there's relative truth and absolute truth. Relative truth means that it's true now, like the book is sitting on the table, but it's not going to be true forever. It's true in the present, but it won't be true in the future, and it wasn't true in the past. So we are looking for a truth that is that we can take shelter of, that will be always true, not just true right now, that will let us down at some time in the future. So if Krishna is Satyavratam, his promise is what? Also, what's another one of his vratas? Kaunteya Pratijaniyi Name Bhakta Pranashati. He asks Arjuna to declare it boldly, that my devotees will never perish. So this isn't a truth that was spoken 5,000 years ago, and it's no longer true because Krishna is no longer driving the chariot of Arjuna. So this is very reassuring if we accept the view of these superior human beings. But again, they are seeing it from the point of the demigod, from the point of view of this creation. Now in Vrindavan, they also see from this point of view, but they see from even a greater point of view. And they may know that Krishna is the absolute truth at times, but all they know is, ultimately, they know that Krishna is our best friend. And he's so wonderful. And when we talk to Krishna, it brings such a satisfaction. We go and play with him. We love him so much. And he's so expert. And any demon that comes, like Bakasura or Vatasura, he kills them. And look how he does this. And look how he plays his flute. And look how he herds the cows. And the cows love him. And the grass loves him. And so that is what is dominant in Braja. So what's dominant in the demigod's consciousness is seeing the Lord as the protector. At this point, he's come to protect. The absolute truth has descended to protect him. Protect him from all the difficult circumstances that arise. So then they say, Satyasya Yonim, they call him. Satyasi, of all relative truths are emanations from the Absolute Truth. You are the yonin, the cause. So anything that is true in this world, it's not maybe absolutely true, but you are the cause of that truth. What's an example of a truth that's not absolutely true, but it's still true? Yes. Right. I was thinking, what's the law? The law, okay, the sun will come up. But that truth rests on Krishna. What one were you thinking of?
Newton's law.
That's what I was, which one was that?
Relativity.
Oh.
Gravity.
Gravity, relativity, it's all one, never mind. It's all has itty in it. So I was thinking of gravity also. So that's true, like the apple falls from the tree and it falls down, and Newton was very intelligent and he discovered it. Of course it wasn't lost, because even before he discovered it, the apple fell down. But he thought, why is this intelligent? Why is Gyani? Why is the apple why doesn't it fall up? So he said there must be some force of nature that causes the apple to fall. So but it's not always true, because maybe in outer space or something the apples fall up, or sometimes different apples. Can apples fall up, Nehru? What do you think? Sometimes.
Yeah, Papa was giving the example, the plants fall in space, they don't fall.
Yeah, and also the, not apples, but water floats in space too. And then when it sometimes comes down, it floats in space in the form of clouds. But it doesn't rain apples, actually. But yeah, so it's not very mysterious, so the scientists will have some way of air pressure this and air pressure that. But there they are. All those, you know, there's thousands of you're the water expert, yes?
No, the universe, the other planets, the gravity is not there, no?
And the planets, the gravity is not there, yes?
It is
not there.
It is not, gravity is not true, basically. Only in Earth it is maybe.
Maybe.
Some aspects.
Some aspects are true.
Mm-hmm. So a small particle is not a gravity at all. For small, very small thing, is gravity doesn't exist.
But yet it exists. Like you always see these little pieces of what are they that float in the air?
Matter.
Huh? Well, little like threads or something. How did they get there? How do they
open?
You mean that's filling the air? Mm-hmm. You mean, how about before people wore natural cloth or something, they still fill the air?
Cat, sheep, and yarn, and cotton,
and they never, they just go there. And you go like this, and they, wow, that's quite amazing.
And they float without going down.
They don't not like apples. Mostly do.
There was a tornado, it would rain apples.
Good point. And there's also, hadn't thought of that one before. But somewhere I was reading some peculiar book last year, and it was talking about every once in a while something really peculiar happens. It's like there's a, you know, in the middle of the desert or something, there's a rainfall of fish or something. I can't figure it out.
Really? All this is true?
No.
Yeah.
Well, they say it's true. Yes?
Singularity,
Jackie?
Yeah.
Huh?
Singularity. Singularity.
Which, singularity?
It means it happens once and nobody knows why it happened or how it happened.
It's happened more than once. Not apples, though. It hasn't happened with apples. But fish, it's happened.
If you're waiting in the desert for a downfall of fish or something.
Yeah, it's going to take a while.
A very long
or it time. Might happen.
So when it actually happens, it's considered a singularity.
I see. A singularity event.
Some freaks.
But in the desert, I observed the ice has also fallen. Ice.
From the sky?
No, yes.
How did the ice get in the sky?
These hailstorms.
Yeah. Happened. Well, you were in the desert.
Yes, I was in the desert.
And it's heavy, right? It's all up there.
Yeah.
It's all heavy.
Yeah, they're all heavy, yeah.
All that ice and the water. And
somebody throwing stone looked like as if.
Yeah.
So this is a relative truth. It's sometimes true and not true.
The tsunami.
Huh?
There hasn't been a tsunami for 80 years. What happened a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So every day you go to the beach and it's in its spot. And one day it's off. The next day it's back in its spot again.
So that the beach will be here is a relative
day,
truth.
Every day for 80 years.
So we're looking for truth. So what we tend to do is look in the material world and we see what we perceive as material reality, and we tend to think that it's always going to be like that. And children need to grow up with that, the illusory security that life is very, very stable. Otherwise, they can't handle the instability of life when they get older. They have to see their parents and this and that, and their parents are people they can rely on. Otherwise, it causes havoc in the consciousness as they get older. But the actual reality is that the material world is always shifting and changing, and it's unstable. It's all relatively true. And just like we naturally think that tomorrow is going to be something like today. I got up today, and maybe I've got to sleep a little late tonight, but I'll get up tomorrow, and tomorrow will be basically like today. But actually, why? Because yesterday was basically like today, and 2 days ago was basically like that. But it's not true. One day we're going to get up, and it's going to be quite different. You know, we'll be terminally ill. It's just going to happen to everyone. So to think of the relative truth as absolutely true is illusion. And therefore, because the living entities, the souls, us, have such a tendency to illusion, to think this is what reality is, and then when something happens, our whole concept of life, it crumbles. It crumbles, like people become disoriented, they don't know how to deal with it, they become terrified when they confront, an example of that was when the planes hit the World Trade Center in New York, a very famous example. The people who were there, not the people who were in the building, but the people who were nearby, and they were completely bewildered. How could this possibly happen? And they were wandering around, bewildered with the ash from the disaster covering them. And how could this happen? You know, our concept of reality is shattered, and it's bewildering, it's terrifying. But yet, it springs from the illusion of accepting temporary truth as absolute truth, as actual reality. Accepting illusion as reality. Illusion meaning not that it doesn't exist, but it's temporarily like that. But Krishna is Tri Satyam. And not only is he Tri Satyam, that he is the truth in all phases of time, but all the relative truths that are true at a certain point in time, but not true in all phases of time, he is Satyasya Yonam. He is the source of those truths as well. Nihitam sa Satyam. And he enters into all the factors, I believe this is what it means, that create the material world, namely five elements, earth, water, fire, ether, and air, that he is the energy that is causing the existence. His potency is causing the existence of everything that we see by his entering into it as the Supersoul. So the scientists like to find out what the cause of existence is. And they have very peculiar methods of, very gross and peculiar methods of trying to discern what the cause of existence is. What is the platform that existence rests on? Because everything rests on something. what is, does existence rest on? So the impersonalists, the Mayavadis, what do they say that existence rests on?
Consciousness.
Yeah, they'll say consciousness, or existence, that oneness of everything. The Buddhists say it, but they say that what we perceive of existence is not really resting on anything, but it's illusion. It's vavarta. It's illusion. What a wild philosophy that is. Now, how are you going to live in the world when you think that everything, that nothing you see exists, actually? You're just basically imagining it. How are you, now, what are you going to do after you figure that one out?
Wouldn't you want to know what does exist, if it all doesn't exist?
But you're also thinking that your thinking doesn't exist. So, because that's also an illusory existence. So how are you going to think about, with something that's an illusion, how are you going to discern reality?
You try and stop thinking of it.
But unfortunately, they may stop thinking, but they don't stop talking. That's the problem. And writing books about it either.
But they have the silent meditation where you meditate on the koan.
Koan? I know.
The sound of one hand clapping or something.
That's Zen. That's Buddhism.
Yeah.
Buddhists, they say everything is nothing, and Mayavadis say everything is illusion. It's one. It's all one. Actually, I remember Mike Harilila one time, we were talking to him, and he said, everything is one, I'm not my body, it's illusion, so I can smoke and do whatever I want, because I'm not really smoking, because I'm not my body, it's only my body that's smoking. So why are you saying that I'm smoking? I was just reading that that's a typical type of impersonal view, Mayavadi view on existence. As Prabhupada puts it, even though they say that everything is illusion, somehow they become expert at enjoying the illusion. So we point to it and we laugh because it sounds so hypocritical. It appears that the depth of realization that everything is illusion isn't very deep. There's no depth to it. But anyway, Krishna is the basis of existence, and everything rests on him. And then one naturally asks, what is Krishna's basis of existence? What does he rest on? And one time that Irish poet asked Prabhupada that question. Basically, who is the father of God? Where does God come from? And then Prabhupada answered that if you understand the meaning of God, you'll understand the answer to that question. What does God mean? It means that he is the one who everything rests on him, but he doesn't rest on anything else. He is svatantra. He is fully independent, and everything rests on him. That is the meaning. Janma dyasya yataha. He is the source of everything. That was Prabhupada's answer. If you understand the meaning of God, then you'll understand the answer to that question. That he is the one that everything rests on, but he doesn't rest on everything. So satyasya satyam, he is the original truth of all that is accepted of truth. Ritta satya netram, he is the origin of whatever truth that is pleasing. Satya Atmakam, everything, he's everything pertaining to the Lord, everything pertaining to the Lord is also truth. It is all composed of the same eternal element. Satchidananda, his body is truth, his knowledge is truth, and his pleasure is truth. Twam, unto you, the demigods say, Sharanam Prapanam. We offer our full surrender to you and we place ourselves under your protection. Now, this is on what this is so different. This viewpoint is so different from Kamsa's viewpoint, because we just heard how Kamsa was always thinking about Krishna, and he was just waiting till he was born so he would kill him. And the demigods are thinking about Krishna as the absolute truth upon which all other truths rest, and they want to, Sharanam Prapanam, they take shelter of him and place themselves fully under his protection. It's also interesting how Prabhupada defines that Prapanam is placing oneself under protection. That's the prime quality of Gotrapte Varanam Tathad, not exactly placing one under protection, because placing oneself under the protection of the Lord is one of the qualities of surrender. But the main quality, or that includes the other quality, is seeing the Lord as one's guardian and maintainer. He's your everything. He's your complete shelter. So the demigod's vision is that Krishna's finally come. Even though he's in the womb of Devaki, they were in anxiety about all the demons, and he's finally come to protect us. So that's their vision. And the absolute truth has descended to protect us. And so their vision is different from Kamsa's vision, and their vision is completely also different from the vision of Mother Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj and the cowherd boys and the gopis and Krishna's friends. They just see him again as this boy. He's ours. He's our friend. That's like we say, this is my wife. This is my child. This is my friend. That whole feeling of self is invested in something that's not us. That's when it becomes mine. When the feeling of self is invested in something that's external to us, we don't say my I, because that doesn't make any sense. Because I am one thing, and be my, there has to be, if it's mine, it has to be something separate from me. So when that whole sense of mine is self is placed in Krishna, he is mine, that is the quality of the mood of the Brijvasis. And they don't see him as, you don't say he is my absolute truth. And this doesn't, you know, param satyam. No, he is my, their love for him is focused in one of the different, of the five different rasas. And in that, when the whole sense of self is invested in Krishna, he is mine. There's I am Krishna's, and Krishna is mine. So the Brijvasis have a dominance of Krishna is mine, even more than I am Krishna's. He's from my village. He's my friend. He's my lover. He is my son. Their whole sense of self is invested in him with such love, and Krishna reciprocates with that, because it's so complete, it's so total, their love, it's love that causes the investment of the self into something that is not the self, an attachment to it. If not love, some attachment, because we get pleasure from it. And even we say he's my enemy. Things like that. Because there's such a bond. That's the bond like Kamsa had to Krishna. But the Brijbasis have the other end of that. He is our Krishna. He is our boy. And he's so wonderful. He lifted up a hill. Our Krishna is so wonderful that he lifted up a hill with just a little finger of his left hand. And the Brijbasi is thinking, oh, it must be because that his father Narayan, his father Nanda Maharaj is such a great devotee of Narayan that Narayan has protected him, his boy, and given him so much power. Because of their love, they could not see him at all in the way that the demigods see him. But yet, because Krishna performs such wonderful pastimes, but there's so much like being in the womb of Devaki. It's so much like what happens to human beings. It's so important to view the vision of someone like the demigods who see the same things that we see, hear the same things that we hear, but because of their greater knowledge and superior consciousness, they see not what we perceive, but they see something very wonderful. So here's the translation. O Lord, demigods pray, you never deviate from your vow, which is always perfect, because whatever you decide is perfectly correct and cannot be stopped by anyone. By being present in the three phases of cosmic manifestation, creation, maintenance, and annihilation, you are the supreme truth. Indeed, unless one is completely truthful, one cannot achieve your favor, which therefore cannot be achieved by hypocrites. So Prabhupada he's not giving a literal translation, but he's most probably putting in some of the points given by the acharyas right into the translation there, so it becomes very strong and instructive. Because as soon as you hear that, indeed, unless one is completely truthful, one cannot achieve your favor, which therefore cannot be achieved by hypocrites. So what do you think when you hear that? How does your consciousness react to that?
You're a hypocrite.
You know, doesn't think, yeah, they're all not going to achieve Krishna because they're all hypocrites. That's another way one hears that.
What do you mean? That one and that one?
Yeah, that one. Everyone else is a hypocrite. And they won't get Krishna. That's another consciousness. Because our consciousness reacts according to when we hear holy words, our consciousness will react according to our consciousness. And when the Paramhamsas hear the Bhagavatam, they achieve the greatest of ecstasies. When the aspiring devotees, sadhakas, hear the Bhagavatam, it's like medicine. And sometimes medicine can be bitter, even, but it's like medicine. And when the materialists hear the Bhagavatam, it gives them pleasure too. That's a sweet coating on the medicine. Nivritta-tasharapakiyamanam.
Only if they're free of hypocrisy.
But how can a materialist be free of hypocrisy?
So how can it give them pleasure?
Because that's the special nature of the Bhagavatam, that it gives pleasure to the three different kinds of people.
But it seems like a lot of people avoid the Bhagavatam who are materialists.
Yeah, certainly. But if they hear it, yeah, but so because it's medicinal. I mean, not the philosophy as much as, you know, when you hear the pastimes and stories of Krishna. It's very popular when you have in India, you have a Bhagavad Gita. You know, just ordinary people who are, but you know, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people will come.
Totally changed my life to listen to Krishna's pastimes, the tenth canto. It was crazy. My mind was totally crazy until I started hearing those pastimes, and it took about a year, a year and a half, and I felt I was becoming sane. But it was an amazing effect. Just to hear those passed on.
You were hearing what? What were you listening to specifically?
My brother and...
No, what were you listening? What, you were hearing it on your iPod?
You know, my tape deck, yeah. Just in the garden,
whatever
I was doing.
When you were coming back towards Krishna consciousness?
Yeah, about 15, 12, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm.
I have a question. We're talking about this mind, like that. And the glory of that, when we first come to try and become practicing devotees, we try to get rid of that kind of possessiveness, or you know, the sense of things that are mine, and we say it belongs to Krishna. We try to make an adjustment, and we're asked to look at things in a very neutral way. So how do you go from that? How do you make that transition from possessiveness of this world to neutrality to a real possessiveness? How does that develop?
What do you mean, how does it develop?
Well, you seem to be having spent so much time saying it's not mine. It's not mine, it's not mine. I don't have to do with it. It's just a material world. I don't, you know.
But, okay. But it exists, okay? So it's not yours, but whose is it? So that's what you start. So first you can say, it's not mine, it's not mine, it's not mine. Then you can say, whose is it? Whose is it? Whose is it? Then you can say, it's Krishna's, it's Krishna's, it's Krishna's.
Even to say that it's not mine is only half the truth. We don't really believe in that.
You mean it's not fully honest?
No.
No, of course. But I mean, that's what we're practicing, to nullify the possessiveness that is the other half that Bunky's referring to, the hypocrisy. We're aiming us towards this neutrality all the time.
But we're not, really. We're aiming towards positive. But in the beginning, we take the that's more the preaching of jnanis, actually.
Bhagavad Gita speaks like that.
That's more the preaching on the jnani level, mm-hmm. actually. We have to hear all the time about the... We have to, because our tendency is to enjoy the material world so much, try to use it like that, so we tend to need to emphasize how the material world is a place of death and this and this and all kinds of morbid, distasteful things because of our tendency to enjoy. But actually, aversion is not the proper mood towards the material world. Rather, it is neutrality in the sense of that this is Krishna's and it should be used in his service. My possessively neutral. And we take what we need to survive, to exist in a simple way according to our capacity, and everything should be used for Krishna. That's the principle of Yukta Vairagya, proper principle. But because in the beginning we have such a tendency to enjoy, you know, and Prabhupada would say the utility is the principle, everything should be used in Krishna's service. But then after that he would say, but purity is the force that gives utility as the principle of strength. So because we need to develop the purity so it becomes honest. And then as we get older, even though there's a tendency of course to become attached, we see the futility of material attachments. We see our very body crumbling before our eyes. And we think, what is the use of this? I'm so attached to this and this and that. And the truth really, it dawns very, very brightly, like a bright summer's day. It dawns that it's true that these things aren't mine, because I'm going to leave and these things are going to remain behind in some form or another. So what binds us here is the tendency to enjoy the material world. So the medicine we take, especially in the beginning, is stop the enjoying mood. It's not yours. But really what we need to hear also is that it's Krishna's, and it should be used for Krishna. It's His. He will be here in all phases of time when you will change your situation. More pleasing.
And then have the next step, in other words, going from the mind of these things in this world to the Krishna's mind?
Yeah, exactly. That's a nice way to put it. The sense, and also the third canto of the Bhagavatam, Kapila Muni's teachings, he said, is when the attachment is supposed to be transferred from the objects of the material world to a sadhu, then it's perfect. But then the sadhu is supposed to speak Krishna Katha. So he's supposed to transfer, because he's right in front of you. He's right there. He's undeniably there, like Prabhupada was for us. And then his Krishna Katha is supposed to transfer the power of his Krishna Katha, transfers the attachment that he has for Krishna, due to the potency of his words, will transfer that attachment to our hearts. That's the essence of the process of hearing Krishna Katha.
So the sadhu is the one who makes this helps one make this transfer from neutrality
and his instructions
to
and the books.
Pure sense,
yeah, sure. The association of devotees is at the very heart of the process. It's at the very essence of the process, and that was the point we read about that, because that will bring even Krishna under control. It's the prime element of the process.
One question. Like as a devotee, you might one might become proud that I'm a devotee and I had a chance to listen to Krishna Katha. Or I am practicing or chanting the rounds, and that might come in the way of being humble towards being equal to everyone and actually achieving the permanently going back to Godhead, because one can become proud. That's what I have to get rid of, that pride that you have, or the ego that you have as a devotee, ego of a devotee, that could come in your way to go back permanently.
There's many ways you can. I've heard Prabhupada answered on two sides of this one. Mm-hmm. One, he even said one time, there was a young boy who some of the devotees were saying he's very proud, and Prabhupada said he has a lot to be proud about. That there is the pride of there is a devotee's pride too. That's not false ego, but it's proud to be a servant of a very kind master. So it's pride in the master. But what you're talking about is something that's out of proportion to our size, because we're tiny and insignificant. So if you think I'm a wonderful, great devotee, which is one of the stages that Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur speaks about as an anarta, that makes the heart unsteady, the pride of youth, so to speak. And you go through life, you take a service, And you try to do it in a wonderful way for Krishna's pleasure, and then you find out how insignificant you are. Try to do it steady, try to do it in a way just for Krishna. Do it day after day, year after year, and you become humble. Like it says, so many of the people who used to distribute books on behalf of Prabhupada found out, you know, some days you're trying to distribute books and everyone's taking one, and the tendency is just saying, is to think, yeah, I'm so good at this, I'm really good at this, no one's better than me at this. But then what must happen by Krishna's arrangement is that on one day you can't do anything. You're trying your best, you're using all the same techniques that you use every day, and no one wants one. So then that's your opportunity to actually become a devotee, because then you start depending on Krishna, and then you realize, I thought it was me before doing it before, but actually it was Krishna before. So there's the process is including association, chanting, hearing, the living in a holy place. But if you just try to do some service steadily, then the process really works. You put it together, all the things that we do for purification, and let it manifest as some service, and then humility comes as a result of trying to giving your life to Krishna and seeing that you're quite incapable of doing that.
Service,
what
service, you
know,
when you say service?
Whatever, doing something to please Krishna. You take up some service and do it. And it's not easy. You have to struggle. You have to struggle against the world. You have to struggle against your own mind. You have to struggle against the difficulties of the body, you know, or whatever. You don't feel like it. Try to do something whether you feel like it or not, regularly for Krishna. For his pleasure. Try to do something and be renounced from the fruits, but do it for Krishna. And then we learn humility. We learn humility by going through life as a devotee. We think we're so great, but then we find out that no one else thinks that we're so great. They see something that we don't see. Okay, why don't we stop because it's getting late. Time. Time works its magic to teach us humility. And Prabhupada even said, an old man can't be proud. Because all the things that we're proud of, time will take away. You know, we look in the mirror and we're proud of our beautiful hair, we're proud of our good smile, we're proud of our strength. We can do this better than everyone else. But when we're old, we can't do anything better than anyone else. It's a great embarrassment, and you become more and more dependent on others.
And your memory goes.
Your memory goes. Your ability to sing goes. Your teeth go. Your hair goes. I remember I told you about that program, that iPad program that I saw. I think it's called the Aging Program, a free download, and you take a picture of yourself. And then you push the lever over, and it shows you what you're going to look like in 10 years. 10, 15 years, you can push it as far as you want. So I looked at the ratings of it today. So 700 people commented. I don't know how many people downloaded it. It's a free program. But 700 people commented on it. They gave a rating of it. Out of that, 640 people said, this is a terrible program. If they did one the other way, you know. But 60 people said it was really great, but it didn't say what their comments were.
What? No. Do you know what the name of it is?
I could go back and look. It's an iPad program, isn't it? This one. You want to find out what
you can... have an iPad.
Well...
But somebody should have written absolute truth. They should have written.
Huh?
Then it will be better. Absolute truth. Somebody should have written that instead of terrible.
They didn't comment so much, but they have a rating system of 1 to 5. So people didn't like it. And they blamed the program.
It looks like with criminals that haven't seen for 10 years, they have an artist's impression of what they look like now.
This is the illusion we keep, you know.
But often they're inaccurate. Nobody
wants to face the reality, so illusion is nice.
Yeah, and reality is terrible. Don't buy this program. And it's like one of those things, it's a free program. And
you know.